This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Step into a world where ancient wisdom meets modern mysticism. Introducing the Gnostic Tarot, a powerful fusion of esoteric art and Gnostic themes designed for those who seek the ultimate gnosis. This mesmerizing deck, rich in symbolism, draws from the profound teachings of Gnosticism, serving as an ideal companion for meditation, reflection, and the exploration of spiritual realms. Whether you are a seasoned tarot enthusiast or new to the practice, the Gnostic Tarot caters to all, offering a portal to ancient wisdom and a tool for uncovering the hidden truths in your mystical journey. Unveil the mysteries, embrace the wisdom. The Gnostic Tarot is a timeless companion for your spiritual odyssey. Take a journey with Gnostic luminaries and learn their stories in a visually stunning manner. From Sophia to the Gnostic Christ, their journey is your self-discovery. Choose from the basic deck or the deluxe version, which includes a beautifully crafted journey book and a magnetic storage box, ensuring that your Gnostic Tarot remains a treasured companion on your spiritual quest. The Gnostic Tarot is an original and collaborative effort between Miguel Connor of Aeon by Gnostic Radio and Matthew Schmitz of Altrusian Grace Media. Visit our website to embark on your journey today. Syncrasis Publishing, where ancient wisdom and modern mysticism converge. Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is, especially if you have yourself the Gnostic Tarot, which I thought would be a good intro since it's got that medieval grail energy, which is our topic today. And yes, my wife will have some of these tarots at the Astrognosis conference in about 2 weeks, and she will be giving readings. She's one of the best readers I have ever met. And there's a whole lot of other excellence happening at this conference. So get your tickets. Online tickets are available. As I was talking to our guests, this is the age of Hermes, the age of the trickster. You need as many tools as you can. The old ways don't work, and the tools of symbolism, myth, and archetype is what's going to get you to the other side in some semblance of sanity. So, but this is also the solution here. My name is Miguel Connor, your Pompidus of Gnosis, and welcome to Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio. And yes, I'm very excited about this topic today because I feel it is so rich in all the stuffy stuff and gnosis we need today. And it is truly an honor to have back at the virtual Alexandria, Dr. Paul Bishop. And he will be discussing an amazing book, which I enjoyed, Jung and the Epic of Transformation. Paul, thank you very much for coming back.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me back a second time. I'm delighted to be here. It might be a virtual Alexandria, but it's more real than a lot of what's going on at the moment.
Very true. And believe it or not, even with all my drivel, it's more logical in many ways. And I think that's what we're going to find out. It really comes down to the experience and what's underneath. And with us too, we've got Mr. Graham Pong. Vance is busy with his day job, his Clark Kent identity. So Graham, thanks for keeping us company today on this Mercury day.
Always fun to fill in, and I'm looking forward to learning more about the Grail. So when it comes my time to pick, I can choose wisely.
Exactly. And awesome. Yes. And as we joke, I hope you've got your coconuts as we go on Monty Python's quest to find this Grail. I see people already in the chat. Good to see HP Lovecraft is there. Hey, Melissa. And hey, everybody else, if you have any questions or remarks, as always, please super chat them so we can separate them and Graham can get to your issues or questions. And we always hope there's no Wetiko in the chat turning into Chetiko. But as always, there's always great conversations there and afterwards in the comments section. So I think that's it as far as housekeeping that I have right now. Yes, as always, please support this Red Pill Cafeteria. Like, subscribe. Sub anywhere you can. You can join as cheaply as $1 a month on Patreon, because I know these are challenging economic times for some of you, and you will get certainly the full shows and other cool stuff that I put out every month. So yeah, please support AM Byte. Help keep the lights of the Pleroma on. So let's get to the main event. Let's get to the quest. Tell us about this book and how you came about it, Paul.
Yeah, thanks. It's well, first of all, a big shout out to Chiron Books for publishing what's going to be a series. And what it's basically trying to do is to explain why is Jung epic in so many different reasons and so many different ways, so many different resonances that we have with that term. And what I've tried to do is to set out four canonical texts at a time when the canon is disappearing, and saying, well, look, maybe Jung can help us recover the meaningfulness of these works. And also, since they were so meaningful and important for Jung, perhaps we'll understand Jung a bit better as well. So I'm trying to do a little bit of interdisciplinary bridge building here, trying to bring German studies, canonical studies, and analytical psychology together. And all that, of course, is trying to explain what is gnosis really about.
Well said, and I think you do the job beyond your breakdown. I love how at the beginning you give a good summary of all the different and wonderful interpretations of the Grail in the past 20, 40 years, 20th century, which tell us that this idea is still so fascinating. I mean, you bring Julius Evola and his view of the Grail, Manly P. Hall. You bring up Ralph Ellis and his ideas, Holy Blood and Holy Grail. The one that, of course, I really like is who was a guest last year, I believe, is John Michael Greer, and his last book on the Grail, which really, I agree, shows how the Cathars, the Knights Templar, the ancient Gnostics were really connected to this legend. And it's not just fanciful fables, but there's actually there's data showing how important and connected they were. So how was this research, and does this complicate the legends of the Grail, Paul, or what do you think?
Well, I think you're right, first of all, to say that, you know, now is a great time in Grail studies, but in a sense, there's never been a time when it wasn't, that, as you say, it has always been present. It is a great perennial topic, to use that word, and yet at the same time, it seems to me that there's an opportunity here to bring Grail studies really to the center of what we're doing at the Arts of Humanities, which are, you know, meant to be in a crisis, and I think you can say with good reason they are, and it's a crisis of meaningfulness, and the Grail absolutely addresses the question of meaning. Because, as we'll talk about, it involves asking the right question and so on. So I think I wanted to begin this series of books, which is going to go on and look at Goethe's Faust, look at Nietzsche's Zarathustra, and then the big one, the Red Book, as the kind of culmination of it, and to take the Parsifal version of Wolfram von Eschenbach as, you know, a kind of starting point in this in the series, and also to get people to go and read Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal. It is just such an incredible text. And Jung senses that, and he senses, of course, Jung has these wonderful antennae for anything that is mythic and archetypal. And even if he doesn't quote directly from Wolfram as much as he does directly from Goethe's Faust and Nietzsche's Zarathustra, nevertheless, the Grail and what it represents emerges at significant points in his work. So the impetus, to come back to your question, comes out of trying to see something meaningful in this scintillating archetype of the Grail. Is it difficult? Well, it absolutely is. It's a very, very difficult and strange subject, but that's what makes it the Grail. If it were easy to go out and get it, if it was just those coconuts you were talking about, then it wouldn't be the Grail. There's got to be the difficulty. And of course, the biggest difficulty of all is suffering. That's the big and difficult question. And that is right at the heart of the Grail myth, the Grail legend, and preeminently in Wolfram von Eschenbach's treatment of it.
Oh, yeah, indeed. And well said. I mean, yeah, because even the examples I give, the Grail is so much to so many different people. As I mentioned, John Michael Greer says it's this ancient technology of nature that was smuggled by the Gnostics, the Nessines, the Cathars. Others have said, of course, in the Dan Brown era, it is the holy blood of Jesus or the child of Mary Magdalene. To others, it is immortality. If we go with Indiana Jones, it is some have said it is a meteorite called Lucifer or Kybele. I mean, there's so much, and it continues to engage the imagination. So what would Jung say is the Grail from an archetypal point? Is it simply the Grail is just the archetype of meaning, yeah, belonging, or like you said, the journey that is more important than the destination? What would you say? What would Jung say, or Paul?
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, just to begin by, expanding what you were saying there about the different sources that all come together and collect, as it were, pool in the Grail. You've got Christian legend, Celtic folklore. You've got the Isis book from the Golden Ass, the Metamorphoses of Apuleius. You've got the Corpus Hermeticum. You've got all of these things that are coming in together. And at the beginning of the myth, as it were, there's a lack of clarity as to what it physically is. Is it a cup? Is it a chalice? Is it a platter? Is it a kind of altar piece? So it's even its physical manifestation is something which is puzzling and difficult to discern.
Exactly. And so what do you think is underneath that, or what would Jung say is the, I mean, of course, can we simply say this is also very important to the hero's journey of Joseph Campbell? We go out on some mission, which is us separating from the tribe and going in this growth and coming back with something valuable for the tribe. Simple as that, Paul?
Well, that doesn't sound very simple. Say,
I'm trying to. if my 8-year-old daughter was asking this question, I think that's what I'd say. You go on a journey, you come back better.
Yep. It's a good way of putting it. And I think I'd say you come back a whole lot better, quantumly better. It is a transformative effect. And of course, as you when you were saying, what does it represent for Jung? I think it is an archetype of meaning, but I think it's above all an archetype of transformation. And transformation is related to this category of meaningfulness. I think that's true of all the works that Jung is interested in. Faust, the figure of Faust, undergoes numerous transformations. Nietzsche's Zarathustra is continually going up and down his mountain and dealing with the eternal recurrence and is trying to transform himself into the Übermensch, into the Superman. And that's true of Parsifal as well, who we meet. We get his whole backstory, very complicated backstory, but we see him as someone who is undergoing a process of transformation, undergoing a process which transforms him out from being a a young lad who is, in the medieval German word, tumba, so stupid, someone who doesn't understand the world. And one of the reasons he doesn't understand the world is because of the bad advice that he's given about the world by his mentors and teachers. So in many respects, Wolfram's Parzival is a critique of education as well. And he has to transform himself into what he is. And that is to say, into being the keeper of the Grail, the Grail King. And that this whole wonderful story hinges on the fact that that's what he is by birth, within this very medieval genealogical view of defining one's role in society. But he can only assume that role once he understands that's what he is. He can only assume that role once he has the gnosis.
Well said. And I think beyond transformation, would you say the themes also, and again, this is for those of us wondering why societies collapse, we've turned our back on these, maybe I don't want to call them knightly, but these classic themes, transformation, the journey, but also the suffering. We have to change, and change always hurts. It doesn't mean you've got to, like, again, Monty Python, beating yourself with a piece of wood in the face, but there is a death of the old you and a new you, which is suffering. And at the end is also a contact with the divine, with God, the contact with something that is beyond you, right, Paul?
That's absolutely right. And I think if we can take that as a kind of structural principle, that explains what these works are doing, which is showing us in the Joseph Campbell-like idea of ascent and descent, the catabasis moment down to the depths, rising up again. You have the imagery of the phoenix that's significantly evoked in Parzival, as well as also in Nietzsche's Zarathustra, interestingly enough. Key image too that Jung discusses. In fact, he explicitly relates the Grail to the legends of the unicorn, the legends of the phoenix as well. And that key dynamic is one of transformation. How does one, in Nietzsche has this beautiful phrase, of course, at the beginning of his quasi-autobiographical work, Ecce Homo. So Ecce Homo, behold the man, the reference to the great biblical moment where Christ appears before Pontius Pilate. And he subtitles Ecce Homo, how one becomes what one is. And this how you become what you are seems to me a preeminently Gnostic motif as well. You are divine, you just don't know it yet, but that uncovering and rediscovering of one's identity, that is what gives this immense dynamic to all epics, and to the epic of transformation in particular.
Beautifully said. Yeah, I think I keep, no matter how much wisdom I gain or knowledge, Paul, I always end up going back to the temple of Apollo in Delphi, walking up and there's a sign, know thyself. And I'm like, damn it, come back, know thyself. Damn it. I feel the Holy Grail will be like one of those fortune cookies, and I'll just open it. I'll say, know thy, but that's why we are here. And that's the one thing that the archons don't want us with. They don't want us to know ourselves. They want to distract us, right?
That's absolutely right. And talking about the temple of Delphi, there was a tradition of scholars, pseudo scholars, whatever you want to call them, in the 19th century, of saying that in fact the inscription over the temple of Apollo had two parts. The first part was the one that you've mentioned, know thyself, and the second part, which has got lost, is and then you shall know the mysteries of the universe. And whether it got lost, whether it was there in the first place or not, I think it's a wonderful way of understanding what it would mean to know yourself, that self-knowledge is not something which is solipsistic, only turning in on yourself, only being concerned about yourself. There's a larger universal dimension to it. And in the case of Parzival, I'd say there's a very, very important social dimension to it as well, because Parzival, on his quest for his own identity, has to cure Amfortas. In fact, it's his failure to ask the question that gets him into trouble in the first place. He has to cure Amfortas, but it's also the case that by curing the Fisher King, he cures society as well. So there is a very important soteriological, sociological dimension to this great epic adventure as well.
Indeed. Well, for the audience, could you give a little summary of the story, Wolfram's story of Parzival, or and you do Wolfram, right? And what maybe Wagner changed with it, or just give us a little summary of this tale.
Sure. I'd be glad to do so, but it is mega complicated. it is mega complicated. No wonder Wagner simplified it down to
three stage or three parts.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Still takes up the whole evening anyway. But he has his particular slant in it that which was also of interest to Jung. So we might want to come back and talk about it as well. But a bit like Star Wars, which has its prequels, so there is a kind of prehistory to Parzival as well. That backstory is of Gamoret, his father, who goes off to the East and marries a Belucane. So we have a kind of marrying of West and East, if you like. And Belucane gives birth to a figure called Firefeets. And Firefeets has a peculiar skin condition. He is black and white. He is black and white. He's described as being like a magpie. But this is crucial biological symbol for a metaphysical idea of a theological idea of light and dark. And we'll see Firefeeds coming back in later. Gamoret then returns back to Europe and he marries the significantly named Herzeloida. Herzeloida, close to Herzleid, so suffering of the heart. We've got that key idea of suffering in very early. And it's Herzeloid who gives birth to Parzival. And when Gamoret dies, Herzeloid has to bring Parzival up in the forest all on her own. She is, if you like, the kind of archetypal single mother. And she's very, very caring and loving about her son. So loving, in fact, that she doesn't want to let him go into the world. And she tries to steer him away from engagement in the world. And in particular, when Parzival sees some knights that are going through the forest, Herzeloid is afraid, well, this is going to get her son interested in the world of the court, and she doesn't want him to do that. But there's another dimension to it here, that Parzival thinks one of these knightly figures he sees is God. And why does he do that? Well, because he's got all this shining armor on. And he's told by Herzeloid that God is light. And he gets this little mini theology which says that God is light. And of course, this leaves the question then of, well, where does the darkness come from? Parzival, at this stage, asks a very significant question, very, very simple in medieval High German, was ist Gott? What is God? That's the question that he puts. So one of the key questions that we encounter in this epic. And interestingly, it's a question that it's also been said that Thomas Aquinas asked when he was a five-year-old as well. So you were talking about your nine-year-old daughter. The five-year-old Aquinas is asking these extremely difficult questions as well. He wants to follow the knights and join King Arthur's court, but Herzeloid doesn't want him to do it. So she dresses him up in ridiculous clothes. Okay? She presents it. Yeah, that's it. It's interesting, this theme of dressing, signification of clothes, the clothes versus the armor that he's going to assume later. And he sets off into the world, but he doesn't really understand the way of the world. He's got to understand that. Right. He's not got to embrace the way of the world, but he's got to understand that it's there. I think that's what's so psychologically interesting about Wolfram's story. At Arthur's court, Parzival fights the joust with the Red Knight. And that's a figure that comes back later in Jung's Red Book and takes his armor and he puts it on over these ridiculous clothes that he's got below. He rescues Conduire Amours, another significant name, Conduire Amour, a leading to love, and marries her. And he's given by Gournemanz a crucial piece of advice, which he either understands or misunderstands, depending on how you interpret the story. He's told, nor be thou swift to question. Mm-hmm. And armed with this piece of advice, he sets off into the world to do the knightly thing, and he encounters Anfortas, the Fisher King. and spending a night at the castle of Mont Salvece, so the castle, the mountain of salvation, he sees this very, very strange ritual being carried out. That is the ritual of the Grail, which in the case of Chrétien de Troyes, the version on which Wolfram's Parzival is based, does take the form of a cup or platter. It's less clear with Wolfram. It seems to be more something like a stone. Well, you might think Parzival should ask, you know, what the hell is that Grail thing? He doesn't ask that question. But more importantly, he doesn't ask the question, what is it that ails thee of Amfortas? Mm-hmm. That failure to ask the question means that, as it were, he becomes cut off from the realm of the Grail, which disappears. And this is where we might say that he's able to start his real Grail quest in earnest, which is to rediscover where the Grail has gone, to have another opportunity to ask that question. And as I've said, this quest for the Grail is really a quest for his own identity, because it turns out that Amfortas is his uncle, and therefore he, Parzival, is himself the Grail king. So again, we've got a kind of interesting symbolism of blood relations, but it's really using genealogy in order to explain something metaphysical. There are two important episodes, I think, that one could focus on. One where Parzival, outriding, sees a drops of blood on the snow. And he falls into a kind of trance, into a kind of unbreakable meditation when he sees it there. And again, we've got a very, very rich symbolism here. We've got the erotic quality of the red and the white. We've got the theme of blood. We've seen the theme of blood relations. We've got the idea of the redeeming blood of Christ as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that's packed into these drops of blood that he sees. And the second important moment is on Good Friday, when he encounters the figure of the hermit Trevretent, who tells him the story of the Grail and this beautiful image of the white dove that descends with a wafer in its mouth. Wagner picks up this idea, of course. And he also relates to Parzival a kind of neo-Gnostic story about how the neutral angels brought the Grail to earth, the neutral angels, those fighting between Lucifer on the one hand and the Divine Trinity on the other. Mm. Okay, I told you it was complicated. I'll try and move to the end of it here. The story bifurcates this point into what Parzival goes off and does, and to what another knight, Gawain, goes off and does. And it's worthwhile saying that within the Arthurian tradition, the Grail is associated with various heroes, sometimes with Parzival or Percival, sometimes with Gawain, sometimes with Lancelot. So we have complexity built upon complexity. Anyway, moving towards the end of Wolfram's version, Parzival fights a knight whom he comes across in the forest, who, of course, then turns out to be Firefitz. This is his brother-in-law, as it were. And he goes to the Grail Castle, asks the question. This frees Amfortas from his suffering, which is described in excruciating detail. Terrible, terrible suffering. The stench of the wound is so bad they have to open the windows. It really is the most ghastly suffering. Firefitz falls in love with the bearer of the Grail, Réponse de Joie, so fullness of joy, and marries her. Conduit Amours joins Parzival with their two sons, Cardites and Lohengrin. So we've got another line into the operatic tradition there. And that's how the story ends. That's how Parzival has brought joy to himself through discovering his identity, joy in the form of a family, and joy, Freude, in to his community, to the wider society as well. It's actually
beautiful. Yeah, beautiful summary. And this, for more context, Wolfram wrote this, 13th century?
That's
it's
right.
Germanic, but the Grail story was ubiquitous. It was like Star Wars or The Matrix back then. Everybody knew about it and wanted to do their own remake.
But that's exactly right, that there are numerous versions of it. And of course, one's always tempted to ask the question, well, you know, which version is the right one? But as you say, it's a bit like Star Wars and the Matrix. There, you know, there is no right version. They're all different iterations of one coherent theme. I would say that the Wolfram one is widely recognized as being one of the most sophisticated stylistically, symbolically. He does borrow a lot from Chrétien de Troyes, a Chrétien who writes the medieval French epic about Percival, mm-hmm. or the story of the Grail. And Chrétien never finishes the story. He never brings the story to the end because he dies. So it's an incomplete work for that reason. And Wolfram takes issue with Chrétien on a couple of points of detail and says, well, Chrétien, in fact, didn't get it right. And he refers to another source whom he calls Caillot. And again, there's a lot of academic ink spilt on the question of does Caillot exist or not. Caillot himself says he takes it from an Eastern astrologer called Flegetanis. But what I think we have here is the symbolization of this idea of you try to trace the story back to its origins, you'll never be able to trace it back to its origins. What you've got to do is to think it forward. You've got to think the myth forward, as Jung would say, dream the myth forward. And it's a perfectly decent question, but where does it come from? But the crucial question is where is all this legendary mythical stuff taking us?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well said. Yes, it's like with the Matrix. You want to find out where the Matrix started. I'd say, well, you can go back to the Gnostics, but you can go all the way to Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And Plato would say, I probably got it in Egypt. But again, move it forward to where we are today and make it a living myth. Well, I want to bring in Graham. Any questions on or remarks on your end, Graham?
I was going to say, just fascinating on, his take on the whole Parsifal thing. I sort of view the Grail as the crucible of transformation and all the various forms that takes, the sort of the chamber in which you enter it, you transform, and the transformation happens, and then the new birth emerges. And I was going to say, as far as I agree with the Jung take in the sense of it's like a current carrying us forward. We need to look at it. You can go for the origin, the source of the river, but it's much more important in following the current to the mouth, wherever it's taking you. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it the journey itself is the goal in that sense, isn't it? And this is beautifully embodied in Wolfram's Parsifal and in Arthurian legend more generally by having the knights setting off on their quest, on embarking on a term that's foregrounded in Wolfram, on their aventura, on their adventure. And this is also a term that's picked up by Jung in the Red Book. And so the aventura is really important. It's things happening. It's things happening to you, things happening around you, and you've got to engage with that. You don't simply passively allow it to wash over you, but you have to turn it into an aventura. And it seems to me that process is linked to the idea of transformation. You both follow the river, but you're also working with it. So to flow in the right direction, to speed along and to reach your and to reach your goal. But that goal includes the episodes that you have on route, and that's why the very complicated narrative architecture of Wolfram's Parsifal, every single detail contributes towards understanding the tale as a whole. So it's a beautiful piece of craftsmanship, and these symbols work at different levels: literal, biological, genealogical, and then we might say symbolic and mystical as well.
Well said. Anything else, Graham?
No, I think he covered it very well. I was interested. The other thing I was thinking is, does he take any significance from the dating of it with the Crusades, the Templars, Cathars, Merovingians, that sort of tradition? Does he see it tying in there, tag?
Yeah, no, that's a really important question. Very timely one, I think, for us culturally at the moment. Clearly, the background to the work is Christian, and that's going to be the case, for historical reasons. But it's also going to profoundly affect what we might call the theology of the Grail as well. And there is an awareness in Wolfram. You mentioned the Crusades. Wolfram does write a crusading text, and you might criticize him for his presentation of Islam or his presentation of otherness. But I think, as you could see from the summary that I'm given, he's trying to engage with otherness in a meaningful way, and this whole imagery of light and dark, black and white, is not intended to be polarizing. So we have the right white Westerners, as opposed to Eastern forces or Islamic forces who are on the other side. But rather, it's about a journey of integrating those cultures. And if it's a limitation that for Wolfram, that integration involves the baptism of Hierophantes, we've got to remember this is a medieval text. We're not going to have political correctness in all its forms. But it is not. It's not as a crusading text. It's completely different from the Chanson de Ronde or other texts like that, where you've got a very clear opposition of who's right and who's wrong. Significantly, with Wolfram, we don't have that, and he attempts to bring in Eastern themes into his conception of the work as a whole.
Well said. Yes, and I like about you're talking about the journey. What did Ursula Le Guin said? How you play is what you win, and it also reminds me too of going on this adventure down the river. Jung would be saying yes. In other words, look at your synchronicities. The universe is throwing you synchronicities, whether you're going on a quest or you're just walking down the road in the woods. And if Parsifal had been completely unconscious the whole time, he never would have gotten a single thing, right, Paul? He would have just, he could be out there on the adventure, but he'd miss everything. So keep your eyes open, because God is communicating every second.
That's absolutely right, and that's why one of the great themes, one of the great images of Parsifal, is that of the tracks, the traces in the forest, which you follow, and then very often the path just kind of disappears into the thickets. But of course, that path is there. It's the fact you can't see it doesn't mean that there isn't a path. And it's very clearly foregrounded at significant moments that Parsifal sets off. He's trying to find the way, but he can only do it with a little help from his friends. He can only do it with the help of the advice he's given by Gunamans. Later, the, as it were, full-blown theological story in its Gnostic technicolor that he's given by Trefrid Sent. He has to be helped on his way, just as he's helped to come and see the Grail ceremony in the first instance by meeting this solitary fisherman out there fishing on his own in a lake, who says, "Hey, come along to the castle this evening, and you'll be surprised at what you see."
Excellent. Yeah. And what about the theme? Something for the audience. But in these tales, these Grail legends, whether it's the Fisher King or Parsifal or others, as you mentioned, there's always a noble or a king who's wounded and he's suffering and he needs to be healed. And of course, many people know it from Bormann's Excalibur, where Arthur is just sitting there sick and the land is dead. And it takes, again, there's a Parsifal comes and gives him the grail and he heals and the land heals. What to you is that symbol? Again, John Michael Greer simply means the technology to get humanity once again to really engage with the land and make things grow and help the environment.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think understanding this role of suffering is very important to the view of Jung that's offered by critics like Peter Kingsley, for instance. And in his book Catafalque, Kingsley foregrounds these remarkable grail dreams that Jung has, but he also brings in a letter that had been written by Jung in 1926, where Jung talks about how the problem of crucifixion is the beginning of individuation. There is the secret meaning of the Christian symbolism, a path of blood and suffering. And I think this question of blood and suffering is preeminently there in Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival. And what Jung says is, thus I suffered, says Jung. I suffered and was miserable, but it seems that life was never wanting, and in the blackest night even, and just there, by the grace of God, I could see a great light. Somewhere there seems to be great kindness in the abysmal darkness of the deity. Try to apply seriously, says Jung in this letter, try to apply seriously what I have told you, not that you might escape suffering, nobody can escape it, but that you may avoid the worst, blind suffering. So here I think we have this question of that you were talking about, Miguel, earlier, of the question of meaningfulness and meaninglessness. And meaninglessness is a kind of suffering as well, I think. Would you agree?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Ignorance is not bliss. It's the great sin in Gnosticism and Gnosis, the mother of all sin, not being aware or awake.
Yeah, that's right.
The land of the lotus eaters.
Well, that's right, and it's absolutely at the core of the Parzival story that he should ask this question, but he fails to do so because he has misunderstood the advice that's given him by Gunnermans. I mean, I think Gunnermans's advice is actually very it's relevant. You know, don't be nosy about other people's affairs. You know, don't constantly you don't pitch up at a party and start asking people, you know, how much do they earn or something like that. Don't in the UK at any rate. So his asking lots of questions about people is good advice. But Parsifal, because he's tump and hasn't got his way out of this folly and foolishness, doesn't understand that if you see this remarkable procession that's going on, there are differences between how the grail procession works in Chrétien, how it works in Wolfram. But it's weird, whichever form you go for, it doesn't really matter which, you know, any particular set of details. It's right. A very, very weird ritual, and yet clearly one which exists parallel to another common ritual, that is to say, obviously, Catholic Christianity. This whole focus on the chalice, the sacrifice of the Mass, some of the earliest versions of the Grail in medieval French link this idea between the Grail as the chalice that's on the table at the Last Supper and the chalice that's used to collect the blood of Christ as it falls from the cross. So we've got all of this imagery of salvation through blood, symbolized by the container. And in a way, what Wolfram is doing on one level is transforming that into saying, well, this redemption through blood takes place in the form, is incarnated in the form of Parzival himself as the Grail King, who literally biologically assumes this role. But just as benefiting from the chalice and the sacrifice of the Mass depends on faith, so in the case of Parzival, he has to understand this identity of the Grail King. And he can only work that out through the Aventuren, through these series of adventures that he goes on.
No, it makes sense. And interesting, somebody, I just saw this on the corner of my eye, does God have a subconscious? And I say, yes, he does. His subconscious is nature. And it's not my idea. I believe it's some German mystic. I don't know, it was Bim or somebody, but it's a Germanic idea that God, nature is God's unconscious. And we are, in a way, we can redeem God by going into nature. And even if it seems like we're projecting meaning, like we're humanizing, in a way, we're bringing God out to engage with humans. So that's our, you would say, but that's our holy role as humans, to bring out God's unconscious.
I think you've picked on a very interesting a comment there, because I think this idea, you're absolutely right. We're talking here about figures like Jacob Boehme. We're talking about Boehme's idea was taken up by Friedrich Wilhelm Joseph von Schelling. So we're absolutely there between German mysticism feeding into German idealism. The great German idealist Hegel says that Boehme was the first German philosopher, even. So that's that idea in turn is then taken up by Jung, because Jung certainly believes that God has some conscious, and that of course is what Answer to Job, this late great work of 1952, is all about understanding. And how is it that it's possible to have a world in which they're suffering? I mean, we've got Jung writing that in 1926. 1952, he's returning to it with the answer by saying, well, it is a product of a lack of consciousness, a subconsciousness that's there. And our role is to assume that transformative moment from not knowing into knowing, and that's what we ourselves embody. And so analytical psychology has this fascinating, this curious role of being both psychotherapy on the one hand, and then having a theological, or if you like, a mystical dimension to it as well. Peter Kingsley, I think, would call it a prophetic dimension as well. And we can see that this prophetic dimension is there in the Parzival story, because Parzival is destined to take on this role, but he has to fight in order to be in a position to actually realize it.
Oh, well said indeed. And you also write that the grail can be tied to the hermetic vessel. What do you mean by that, Paul?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to this connection between the hermetic tradition as one of the sources of the grail, and this sense of the relation between the grail and the crater. Now, the crater plays a role, important role in the story of how the universe is created that we find in Plato's Timaeus. Right. And Jung is absolutely fascinated by Plato's Timaeus, and he discusses it. If you look at Collected Works 11, when he's discussing the Trinity, he brings in this theme, and it's related to a motif that Jung plays with a lot, which comes from Plato's Timaeus and is also then picked up in Goethe's Faust. We've got the one, the two, and the three, but where is the fourth? And this motif of the fourth as a kind of representation of wholeness, obviously crucial to Jung's thinking. And I think, to try and package the answer as simply as possible, the idea of the crater being the mixing bowl in which the demiurge mixes the universe as we find it. And of course, that's obviously going to be a key idea that we find in later the Gnostic systems as well. The crater as the mixing bowl, as we find it in the Corpus Hermeticum, again, very, very parallel structures. And then this idea of the grail as the mixing of all the different psychological aspects of the self, which are going to come together and affect our redemption in a psychoanalytic way. I think you can see there's very clear structural parallel between these three different paths, if you like.
Yeah, I would agree too. And also, as we've been talking, yeah, German idealism and mysticism is so beautiful, and I think it's 100% right. Sometimes I tell German friends, you don't understand the past. Yeah, overlook some of the bad parts, but your past is like nothing in this world. It is a top-notch mysticism. But the Hermeticists also said this too, Paul, right? Man is between the god and the beast. Plotinus said it. And so we have this important role to make, help the beasts become conscious and also help the gods become conscious. We have this a very important role in between the universe. And as humans, we should be proud of this quest while we're in the middle. It's not bad.
No, I know you're absolutely right. And I think you've touched on something as well, which is a difficulty that we have appropriating this German mystical tradition, obviously because of the 20th century, right. and yet I think Jung, who of course was not German but Swiss, Jung is himself someone who we might say is trying to rescue the German tradition from its misappropriation or from its misuse. We might cite the example of Wagner there as a good case in point. It's well known that Wagner's music was misappropriated politically in the 20th century, but I think that Jung, who's interested in Wolfram, he's also interested in Wagner's Parsifal as well, offers us a means of recuperating this tradition, of if you like, cleansing it and enabling us to approach it afresh, because it's too valuable simply to allow it to be taken away from us. And I think that Jung, even though he's often criticized on the basis of his presumed politics, that on a deeper level, Jung is all about trying to reappropriate the German tradition for psychological, for psychotherapeutic, if you like, for mystical or metaphysical ends, but for political in the best sense of the word. Because as I've said, Parsifal's redemption is both a redemption of himself, but it's also a redemption of the society around him. It's also a bringing together of Western and non-Western cultures. It's bringing together the light and the light and the dark, and having a richer conception than the Christian background against which it's set. And for that reason, I would describe it as a Gnostic text.
Oh, I would agree. And yes, I mean, things are always complicated, as I keep telling people. I didn't like that person because I knew them. I liked them because they helped me know myself. People are complicated. Wagner, unfortunately, was a raving anti-Semite. But then Nietzsche was a raving anti-Christian who was very fond of Judaism. And then Nietzsche fell out with Wagner because he hated that Wagner was going Christian. He wanted him to stay pagan. So it's complicated. So we got to sort this out.
You're absolutely right, Miguel. It's remarkably complicated. You're right. The reason why Nietzsche is said to have finally turned away from Wagner is because of Parsifal. So you're moving away from pagan Germanic myth, right, to the Christian. But it is more complicated because Lohengrin was another opera, and that's clearly predating Parsifal as well. It's a very, very complex set of relations between Nietzsche and Wagner there. And of course, in the case of Nietzsche himself, you have the curious case of someone who is anti-Christian and yet who keeps going on about Christianity. So as Jung put it, who is it who falls at the foot of the cross? Is it Wagner or is it Nietzsche? And I think that's a very, very useful way of thinking about this problem with Nietzsche as well, who, after all, creates this prophetic figure of Zarathustra to, as it were, do the dirty work for him. So Zarathustra, as a kind of spokesman for Nietzsche, allows for playfulness, ambiguity, all of these things postmodernists should like, but they don't seem to like it when it's applied to the canon of German literature. So we've got a work to do there, I think, still.
Yeah, again, the important thing is that these figures help us know ourselves. They have a role. Don't just cast them all out. They all have value. They all have struggles. We all have blind spots. They had their blind spots, and times change. So, going back to Parsifal, where would you find him in the Red Book? Or what do you think Jung really connects with these ancient Grail mysteries?
Well, if you look at the Red Book in Liber Secundus, and you look in Nox Quarta, there's a very, very strange episode, but I think a crucial one in this series of transformations that the Jung figure undergoes in the Red Book. And Jung says that coming out of the library, which is part of the mental asylum where he is in this part of the Red Book, he pushes curtains aside and sees a high-ceilinged hall before him with a magnificent garden in the background, and he identifies this as the magical garden of Klingsor. Klingsor, who's a marginal figure relatively in Wolfram, moves to the front in Wagner's operatic version of Parsifal. And Jung says, I'd entered a theatre. Just over there were two of them, Amfortas and Kundry. And he sees Klingsor standing there looking a bit like the librarian that he finds in the mental asylum. But he says, but look, Parsifal enters from the left. How strange, he also looks like me. Klingsor venomously throws a feather at Parsifal, but the latter catches it calmly. And then, says Jung, the scene changes. So it's just like a dream where one scene moves into another. It appears that the audience, in this case me, says Jung, joins in during the last act. One must kneel down as the Good Friday service begins. Remember the Good Friday that we talked about in our little plot summary? Parsifal enters, slowly, his head covered with a black helmet. The lion skin of Hercules adorns his shoulders, and he holds the club in his hand. He's also wearing modern black trousers in honor of the church holiday. So again, the ancient and the banally modern combined in one figure. I bristle and stretch out my hand avertingly, but the play goes on. Parsifal takes off his helmet, yet there is no Gornamantz to atone for and consecrate him. Kundry stands in the distance, covering her head and laughing. The audience is enraptured and recognizes itself in Parsifal. He is I. So we have this remarkable identification of Jung with Parsifal. But of course, there are other remarkable moments of identification in the Red Book, the identification with the Deus Leo Centophilus, the identification with Christ hanging on the cross, and the identification with Vodin hanging there from the tree. And I would say that of those transformative moments, this one with Parsifal belonged to them as well. The sense of he is I, the sense of realizing oneself in the other as a crucial part. The scene changes. And it's not just the scene that changes, it's Jung's own understanding, as happens throughout the Red Book, which is, as you know, this whole sequence of transformation, yeah, one after another.
Oh, yeah, I agree, and beautifully said. And what about going to the Red Book? Obviously, an important guide of the soul for Jung was Philemon, although, of course, we later find out he transforms to Simon Magus, but that's more, I think now we're in the Goethe, Mephis, you know, Faustus kind of territory, because as some said, Simon Magus and Faustus, even with the German people, was the same figure. But Philemon, that myth was very popular with the Germanic people. Goethe loved it, Jung, everybody. And it seems such a simple story, right, Paul? You've got the two gods, you've got the demiurge and the trickster who are just going to come and destroy humanity. And they meet this humble couple who's going to sacrifice their guardian goose to feed him. And these gods, making the unconscious conscious. Philemon was able to make Hermes and Zeus conscious of who humanity was and touch them and transform them. So I guess that's Philemon's role, right? He's almost knightly, he and his wife.
that's very, very shrewdly observed, if I may say so. I think you're absolutely right. And Goethe's Faust is going to be volume two, which I'm working on right now.
That's
the next one that's going to be up. And you're right. This extraordinary moment, this terribly tragic episode in Act Five of Faust Part Two, the episode of Philemon and Baucis, which Jung says in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he says, this is what I had to atone for. Is a remarkable phrase. I had to atone for the sin, he says, of Philemon and Baucis, the crime that was committed against them, which is their murder and the destruction of their humble little house with its humble little chapel, where they remember the gods who, as you say, still walked the earth in those days. And yet this figure who is responsible for their death, because Faust tells Mephistopheles to go and get Philemon and Baucis out of the way so that he can continue with his land reclamation project. Yet this Goethean Faust is the figure who is redeemed, a figure who at the end, in the great concluding scene, is transformed. So you can see how Goethe's Faust fits perfectly well into this dynamic that we've discerned in Parsifal, the dynamic as we've discerned it in the Red Book as well. And I think you're absolutely right to say there are structural parallels that mean, rather than looking for, oh, well, there's a particular alchemical reference here, or there's a particular play on words there, and so on, really it's the idea behind alchemy of transformation. Really it's the idea behind the mysteries of transformation. That's what makes these texts so powerful, that they revise, update, present for modern in their own days, and for us now, if we can just set aside the history and see these texts in the linguistic and stylistic freshness that they have, and it seems to me that they are in that sense profoundly Jungian texts, that they are about moving us to reflect on our own process of transformation.
Yeah, well said. Oh, and yeah, and for the audience, I forgot before, we're talking about the Grail legends. As some have noted, after the Cathars were exterminated, the Grail legend sort of disappeared from Europe for a long time. So there is that connection. We've done an hour, Paul. Do you have a little bit longer? Because I have my surprise on Philip K. Dick I wanted to share with you.
Absolutely, yes. No, surprise me. Surprise me. Surprise us all.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten. And the virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.